Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind. Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man, number 39, Assault of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby, with performances by James Lewis, Drew Kopis, Elizabeth Jernigan, Tim Carlin, Johann Detweiler, Richard Rowan, Christopher Sheeran, Terence Aselford, Michael Glenn, Patrick Bussink, Stephen Carpenter, David Coyne, Dan Sontag, Nick DePinto, Thomas Keegan, MJ Casey, Yasmin Twazon, Kimberly Gilbert, Alyssa Wilmoth, Thomas Penny, Eric Messner, Ken Jackson, Scott McCormick, Christopher Graybill, Joe Brack, and Evan Casey.
Bill Dinkins was 38 years old, standing 5 feet 10 inches tall with sandy hair and blue eyes. He was a man that women found handsome at first look, but there was something about him, an evil glint in his eye, the curl of a lip, that upon further examination frightened women away. One fine fall day, Dinkins, Loomis Caldwell, Gary Beeman, and Henry Kilpatrick rode into the town of Buffalo, Colorado. They went straight to the bank. While two of the four stayed mounted, Dinkins and Caldwell went inside and asked for 5 $20 gold pieces in exchange for a $100 note. While in the bank, the two men checked it out, noticing a back door they assumed opened onto an alley. Once they left the bank, the four men rode up and down Decker's Road a couple of times, checking out the lay of the town. Then they rode up the alley to see where the bank door opened. Now, when the four men first rode into town, Glenn Davis, the town marshal, thought nothing of it. But when he saw him ride up and down the street twice, then go into one end of the alley and come out the other, he and his deputy Bobby went outside. The four riders, still unaware that they had attracted attention, rode back into the alley and tied their horses to an empty freight wagon. They split up, with two going into the bank through the front door and two going in through the back door. Three customers and the bank teller were inside.
Up against the wall!
He handed the teller a cloth bag.
Fill the bag with money.
With shaking hands, the teller began to comply.
Bill, hurry up! There's a lot of people come toward us, and every one of them's got a gun.
Give me the bag.
Reaching through the window, Dinkins made a grab for the bag, but the teller jerked it back. Dinkins retrieved the bag from the dead teller.
We gotta get out of here now!
Everyone out the back door!
The four men ran out the back door, then down the alley to their horses. When they reached Decker's Road, which was the main street, the angry citizens of the town were ready for him. Beeman, his chest opened up by the load of double-aught buckshot, was knocked from his horse. Kilpatrick's horse was killed by someone firing a Winchester rifle. And when Caldwell turned back for him, everyone with a gun started shooting at the two men. Kilpatrick and Caldwell's return fire was effective enough to drive several citizens off the street and provide cover for Dinkins.
Bill, come here! Help me get Henry up on Beeman's horse!
Dinkins looked back at the two men, then at the armed citizens, and turned and galloped away.
Dinkins! You cowardly son of a bitch!
Dinkins didn't look back, but continued to ride as the shooting was going on behind him. He rode hard until he realized nobody was giving chase. When Dinkins reached the town of Snyder, he dismounted, slapped his horse on the rump, and sent it on. He hoped if anyone was following him, they would follow the tracks of his horse. He walked the rest of the way into town, then went to the depot to buy a ticket on the next train out. He was pretty sure nobody would be looking for a bank robber on a train. Bank robber. He scoffed at the term. Some bank robber he was. He hadn't gotten away with one red cent. Washington, D.C. Sally Jensen had been back east for almost 6 weeks, during which time she had visited her family in Vermont, friends and relatives in Boston and New York, and as the last part of her trip, she was in Washington, D.C. At the moment, she was sitting in the presidential office. The president was rather rotund, with a high forehead and a bushy mustache. He was wearing a suit, vest, and bow tie, and he was smiling as he walked around the desk with his hand extended.
Mrs. Jensen, how wonderful to see you.
The pleasure is all mine, Mr. President.
Oh, please, tell me all about your wonderful West.
As you say, Mr. President, it is wonderful. You really should take a trip out there sometime.
I agree. I must do that. And your husband, Smoke, he's doing well?
Oh, he's doing very well, thank you. Right now, he and the others are involved in the spring roundup.
The spring roundup. What exciting images those words evoke. Well, please don't tease me about it, but from time to time, I read novels of the West. I find them a wonderful escape from the tedium of reports, analysis, bills, etc., 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 ad nauseum. And how is your family?
Oh, they are doing well, thank you. It was my family who insisted that I call upon you before I return home.
And rightly so. When I was governor of the state of New York, I vetoed the bill that would have reduced the fare to 5 cents on the elevated trains in New York. That was an extremely unpopular veto. And your father's support, even though he was not a resident of New York, helped convince several legislators to change their vote and support me when the legislature attempted to override the veto. Had I lost that veto, I believe my political career would have been finished. I do not think it would stretch credulity too far to suggest that I am occupying the White House partly because of your father's early and important support.
Oh, it wasn't all altruistic on my father's part, you understand, Mr. President. He had loaned Jay Gould the money to buy the railroad. He was merely looking after his investment.
Oh, and here I was certain your father's support was because he thought me to be a brilliant politician and servant of the people.
Sally and the president visited for a while longer. Then, she was invited to have lunch with Frances Cleveland, the president's young wife.
Oh, Sally, have you seen Washington's monument?
Oh, I saw it some time ago, but it wasn't completed then. It was sort of an ugly stub.
Oh, you must see it now. It is all finished, and it is beautiful. If you would like, we'll drive out there after lunch.
Oh, I would love to.
Sugarloaf Ranch. Smoke Jensen was standing in an open field by the barn. 25 yards in front of him were three bottles inverted on sticks of varying heights, one as high as a man's head, one about the height of an average man's chest, while the third would align with a man's belly. The sticks were 10 feet apart. Off to Smoke's right, but clearly in his vision, Cal was holding his right hand out in front of him, palm down. There was an iron nut on the back of his hand, and beneath his hand, on the ground, was a tin pie plate. The full-time hands, the ones who had stayed through the winter, as well as some of the new men, the temporary cowboys who were showing up for the spring roundup, were gathered around in a semicircle to watch the demonstration. Cal turned his hand over and the nut fell. The moment Smoke saw Cal turn his hand, he began his draw. He broke all three bottles before the iron nut clanked against the tin pan. At that moment, Pearlie came driving back in the buckboard. He came all the way up to the men, smiling as he was holding up a letter.
Looks like you got a letter from Miss Sally. Looks like it, doesn't it?
Reckon how long she's gonna be gone before she comes back?
Next week, I believe. Unless this letter says something different.
My darling Smoke, I have enjoyed my visit back east. Please notice that I did not say back home. That's the only home for me is our beautiful sugar loaf. But I'm growing anxious to return. The weather here has been abysmal. It snowed every other day for the 2 weeks I spent in New York. I did get to see a play in which Andrew and Roseanne McAllister appeared. It made me feel special to be sitting in the theater, watching as they enthralled the audience, knowing that their brother and my husband are good friends. I visited Washington, D.C., and President Cleveland asked about you. Smoke, I am used to everyone in the West knowing who you are. But when a hotel concierge, a restaurant maitre d', a hack driver, and the President of the United States ask about you, I must say it does give me pause. Mrs. Cleveland, whose name is Frances, is a most delightful person. She is younger than I am, but is mature beyond her years. She took me on a personal tour of the Capitol, and how fun it was to see the city through her eyes. How glad I am that I stuck to my childhood dream of seeing the wonderful West, and how fortunate I have been in finding you, the love of my life. I shall be returning home next week and expect to arrive in Big Rock at 11 o'clock Tuesday morning. I can hardly wait until I breathe the high, sweet air of Colorado once again. And, if I may be so bold as to put it in your words, to taste the lips of the man of my dreams. Your loving wife, Sally.
Yoo-hoo, boys! She'll be back home next Tuesday.
Reckon we'll be through riding bog by then?
Oh, you ain't never really through riding bog, Cal. You know that.
Yeah, I know, but it's generally worse right after winter's over. Then starts easing up some.
Another necessary but unpleasant job would be cleaning out the water holes. It would require a team of horses and a scraper. Depending on the size of the hole and how much weed, mud, and cow dung there were in the water, it would sometimes take up to a week just to clean one hole. Of course, even before the general roundup was done, there'd be a roundup of all the newly born calves so they could be branded. This was the kind of work that was keeping Smoke, Pearly, Cal, and the other cowboys, those who'd been present all winter and those who were newly signed on for the spring roundup, busy. When Sally Jensen stepped down from the train, it was nearly midnight. Dark and cold, the little town of Big Rock was a windy emptiness under great blinking white stars. Sally had written to Smoke, telling him she would arrive mid-morning Tuesday, but when she was in St. Louis, she took advantage of a faster connection, which caused her to arrive in Big Rock almost 12 hours ahead of her schedule. At first, she thought only of the time she'd be saving, not realizing it meant that she would arrive in the middle of the night. She was alone on the depot platform, and there was no one to meet her. Behind her, the engineer opened his throttle. As the train pulled out of the station, Sally watched the cars pass her by. Most of the windows were dark because the passengers were trying to sleep. But the windows of the day cars were well lit, and she could see the tired faces of passengers who were either unable or unwilling to pay for more comfortable accommodations. As the train left the station, she turned to walk toward the depot. Because there would be no more arrivals or departures until the next morning, the waiting room, which was dimly lit by the yellow light of an oil lantern, was empty. The ticket window was open, but there was no one behind the counter. She could hear a telegraph instrument clacking from the telegrapher's office, so she assumed someone was there.
A miss?
Oh!
Oh, sorry, ma'am. I didn't mean to... Why, Miss Jensen! What are you doing here at this hour of the night?
Hello, Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Anderson was the baggage and freight agent.
I wasn't supposed to get here until tomorrow morning, but I took an earlier train out of St. Louis. I don't know what I was thinking. Of course, there was no way of letting Smoke know in time to meet me. So I haven't gained a thing. It would appear that I have been hoisted by my own petard.
You been done what, ma'am?
Oh, I'm just commenting on how foolish I was to change trains, is all. Did my baggage get off?
Yes, ma'am. I got it out on the platform right now.
Could you keep it until tomorrow morning for me? I'm going to have to get a hotel room, I'm afraid.
Oh, yes, ma'am. Well, if you'll wait until I get your baggage put away, I'll walk with you to the hotel. It's not all that good for a lady to be out here in the street in the middle of the night alone.
I would be happy to have you accompany me, Mr. Anderson.
As Sally walked down the street, escorted by Mr. Anderson, she pulled her shawl more tightly around her. The moisture clouds of her exhaled breath were almost luminescent in the dark night. They reached the McKinley Hotel, a three-story brick structure that was one of the finest buildings in Big Rock. It had a very nice restaurant on its ground floor. Inside, a dozing clerks sat behind the desk in an empty lobby. In the middle of the lobby, a wood-burning stove roared and glowed red as the fuel burned.
I'll leave you here, ma'am.
Oh, thank you.
Sally walked over to the desk and smiled as she saw the clerk. His head drooped forward.
Mrs. Jensen, what a pleasant surprise. You be taking a room with us?
Yes, I've just arrived on the train, and Smoke isn't expecting me until tomorrow. I do hope you have an available room.
Indeed we do.
The clerk turned the register around so she could sign it. Picking up the pen, Sally saw a name on the line just above hers.
Tamara Gooding McKenzie? Well, that has to be Tamara Gooding. Is she here?
Mrs. McKenzie? Yes, she checked in about 6 this evening. She came in on the afternoon coach from Gothic.
Tamara is an old and dear friend of mine. Please do not let her leave tomorrow without seeing me.
I will tell her you are here.
As was his routine, especially during roundup time, Smoke Jensen was up before dawn. He stood in the doorway of the cookhouse. Even though he was in silhouette, it was easy to identify him. He had shoulders as wide as an axe handle, strong arms, flat stomach, and stood just over 6 feet tall. For the 6 weeks Sally had been absent, Smoke had been taking all his meals in the cookhouse, eating at a private table where he was occasionally joined by Pearlie or Cal. They believed, as did Smoke, that as they would be working closely with the cowboys, they should eat with them. It was early enough that none of the other cowboys were awake yet, but Pearlie and Cal had been with Smoke long enough to know his schedule, so they were having their breakfast with him at his table as they discussed the roundup.
We've got cattle scattered from hither to yon. It's going to take about 2, maybe 3 weeks to get them all rounded up, branded, and ready to drive into Big Rock to the railhead.
Miss Sally gets back today, don't she?
Don't say that in front of her.
Don't say what?
Don't say don't she. It is doesn't she.
Oh, yeah. Her being a school teacher and all, I sometimes forget what store she sets by talking good English. What?
Never mind. You are incorrigible. And I would merely be casting pearls before swine.
Smoke, I tell you the truth, sometimes you don't make no sense at all.
Miss Sally does get in today, though, doesn't she?
Yes, I'll be going into town to pick her up this morning.
At breakfast in the dining room of the hotel, Sally and Tamara sat across the table from each other. They had been classmates at Vassar and later taught together. This was the first time they had seen each other in a long time.
Yes, I knew you were living here, but I didn't want to bother you with my troubles.
Tamara, we are friends. Friends are never a bother. Now, please, tell me what is going on with you.
Shortly after you and Smoke Jensen were married, I married a man named Ian McKenzie.
Did he live in Bury?
No. I left Bury and went to Denver to take a position there. That's where I met Ian. He was a lawyer and a wonderful man.
Was?
He took cholera and died 2 years ago.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yes, it was awful. I miss him so. But to make matters worse, I found out his law partner had been cheating him all along. I'm sure that Ian died thinking I would be well taken care of, but there was nothing left of his estate. I left Denver with nothing but the clothes on my back.
Tamara, if you knew I was living here, you should have come to see me.
I couldn't do that. I won't be a burden to my friends or to my relatives.
Where are you living now? And what are you doing in Big Rock?
I am living in Gothic.
Gothic? Why, that's very close to here. Tamara, if you were that close, you should have come to see me.
I planned to do so once I got back on my feet.
Are you teaching in Gothic?
No. I applied, but there is no position for me. I have been earning a living baking pies and cakes and selling them from my house. I've actually done better than I thought I would, so that gave me the idea of starting a restaurant.
Why, Tamara, that is a wonderful idea. So why are you in Big Rock? Do you plan to start it here?
No, the restaurant will be in Gothic. To tell the truth, I have come to get some ideas from the people who are running this restaurant. There is already another cafe in Gothic, and I'm not sure they would be all that happy to have competition, so I thought I would do my research over here.
Well, I remember what a good cook you were, even when we were in college. You would sometimes prepare a veritable feast for us. I think your restaurant will do wonderfully.
Oh, thank you. I hope I can convince Mr. Flowers.
Mr. Flowers?
He owns the Miners Bank in Gothic. I will be applying to him for a loan to get my restaurant started.
How much money will you be asking him for?
Quite a lot, I'm afraid. From all I have been able to figure, I'm going to need at least $2,000.
You've got it.
No, I don't have it. That's why I'm going to have to borrow from the bank.
No, I mean you've got the loan. There is no need for you to go to the bank. I will lend you the $2,000 you need.
Oh, Sally, no, I told you. I don't want to be a burden to my friends. And I especially don't want to borrow money from them. Why, what if the restaurant doesn't make it?
What would you do with the bank if the restaurant doesn't make it?
I don't know. To be honest, I haven't thought it through that far.
That's because your restaurant is going to make it. I'll come over next week with the $2,000 you need. If you truly are my friend, you won't upset me by turning this offer down.
Oh, Sally, what a wonderful friend you are.
Colorado State Penitentiary, Canyon City, Colorado. The prison guard walked down the center aisle between flank and rows of cells, carrying a large ring of keys. He stopped in front of one of the cells, and the prisoner, as was the routine, stepped all the way back to stand against the wall.
What's your name?
Hell, Jack, you know who I am. I'd have been here for 5 years.
You do want to get out today, don't you?
Yes.
Then you'll do this my way. What is your name?
Parnell. Cole Parnell, number 1210.
Step out into the aisle, Parnell, and come with me.
Parnell did as instructed until they reached the far end of the aisle, where Jack went through the same procedure with a man named Johnny Putnam, number 1138. Parnell and Putnam marched in step with Jack toward the lock gate at the other end of the aisle. They were taken to the warden's office. Each was given a new pair of jeans, a denim shirt, and a wool coat. They took off their striped trousers and striped shirt to put on the new clothes, and they got $5 apiece.
I had a gun and a holster when I checked in here.
Yeah, I did too.
The warden nodded, then opened the bottom right drawer of his desk.
Here are your guns. No bullets. I would suggest you don't use them for anything other than shooting varmints and the like.
Don't worry none about that, warden. I ain't planning on doing nothing that will get me back in here. No offense meant, but this here prison ain't exactly a high-class hotel.
Why, thank you, Mr. Putnam. I'll take that as a compliment. It is our intention to make your stay here as unpleasant enough that you will think twice before doing anything that might cause you to return.
15 minutes later, the two former prisoners walked through the door at the front gate. They stood for a moment, as if adjusting to the fact that for the first time in 5 years, they could see from horizon to horizon without walls around them.
Damn, this feels good.
Don't it, though?
What are you going to do now?
I'm going to find a near saloon and have a beer. No, not a beer. Whiskey. Real whiskey.
Bill Dinkins was sitting in the Red Dog Saloon when he saw Johnny Putnam and another man come in. Dinkins knew that Putnam was getting out of prison today, and it was for that reason he had come to Canyon City. He watched as the two men stepped up to the bar to order drinks. Their new jeans and shirt, plus the $5 bill each of them plunked down on the bar, telegraphed to everyone in the saloon that they were just released prisoners. The other saloon patrons moved away pointedly.
Putnam!
Hearing his name, Putnam turned toward the caller. Dinkins held up a half-full bottle.
Save your money. You two boys are welcome to drink at my table.
Putnam smiled and tugged on Parnell's arm.
Come on. There's no part of mine.
The two men picked up their $5 bills and walked over to the table before the bartender returned with two shot glasses of whiskey. Seeing what had happened, he shrugged his shoulders and then poured the whiskey back into the bottle.
Who's your friend?
Name's Parnell. We both got out this morning.
Where are you going next?
I don't know. I don't have a horse. I only got $5. Don't seem to me like there's many places I can go.
You interested in a job?
By job, you mean the kind of job that got me in prison in the first place?
I can furnish each of you with a horse and saddle and $20 advance.
It is the same kind of job that got me in prison in the first place, isn't it?
You got any better prospects?
No, I don't reckon I do.
I don't know about Johnny, but if the offer is for me as well, I'm in.
Yeah, like you said, we don't have no other prospects.
Come on down to the stable. We'll get the two of you mounted.
The three men stood up and started away from the table.
Don't leave the whiskey behind. It's already paid for.
Parnell walked back to the table and grabbed the bottle.
Now, when we get to the stable, let me do the talking.
15 minutes later, the three men left Canyon City, heading west.
When you said you supplies with horses, I didn't know you was talking about renting horses. Hell, how far can we go on rented horses?
As far as we want, seeing as I don't plan on turning them back in.
Ha! That's why you've been renting horses there, ain't it? Planned all along to do this. You just making him trust you.
Your friend is smart. Now, if you boys just pay attention to me and do what I tell you, you'll have more money than you know what to do with.
Ain't possible. No matter how much money I have, I always know what to do with it.
Smoke Jensen drove a buckboard into town to pick up Sally. It would not only be good for carrying her luggage, it would also be good for him to pick up a few supplies he needed. He was at least half an hour early for the train, but he figured it would be better to be early than late. He was checking the blackboard in front of the depot to get the latest telegraphic report on the train.
Smoke, I'm over here.
Smoke looked at Sally with a shocked expression on his face.
Sally, what are you doing here? According to the schedule, the train isn't due for another half hour.
The train isn't due for another half hour, but the train I was on arrived at midnight last night.
What? Why didn't you tell me?
I changed trains in St. Louis. I should have known it would arrive here in the middle of the night. I just didn't think about it.
You didn't spend the night here in the depot, did you?
Oh, of course not, silly. I stayed in the hotel. Tell me, Smoke, am I just going to stand here like a toad on a log? Or am I going to get a welcome home kiss?
Smoke went to her, where they embraced and kissed deeply and unashamedly on the brick platform in front of the depot.
I had Mr. Anderson hold my luggage overnight for me.
Good. But if you don't mind, we'll come back for it a little later. I have some things I need to pick up. Some wire and fence posts.
It's roundup time and you put the fencing off until the last minute, haven't you?
I have an excuse for it. I hate fences.
As they left the depot, they saw a stagecoach drawn up in front of the stage depot.
Smoke, drive over there. I want to tell a friend goodbye.
Smoke drove over to where the coach was being loaded. Sally looked toward the passengers and smiled when she saw Tamara.
Tamara?
With a glance toward the coach to make certain she wasn't going to be left behind, Tamara hurried over to the buckboard.
Smoke, you remember Tamara Gooding, don't you? Only it's Tamara McKenzie now.
Yes, yes, I do remember you. It's nice to see you again.
Thank you. I'll be coming over in a couple more weeks.
Sally, are you sure you want to do this?
I'm positive I want to do it.
I'll write to you.
Tamara hurried to board the coach, the last passenger to do so. Smoke held his own team back until the coach pulled out.
Want to do what?
Invest in a restaurant.
After the coach left, Smoke drove down Main Street, exchanging greetings with the citizens of the town that he had helped form. The Jensens were well known and respected, and if everyone in town didn't know them personally, everyone in town certainly knew who they were. Sheriff Monte Carson was sitting on the boardwalk in front of his office with a cup of coffee in hand.
Howdy.
Smoke grinned and tipped his hat, and Sally smiled and waved.
You going to stop into Longmont's?
Yeah, as soon as I get a few things from the hardware store.
I'll join you then.
Good.
What am I supposed to do while you're visiting with all your friends in Longmont's?
I figured you would want to stop by the general store. You always do that when you come to town.
That's true.
Then you can come on down to Longmont's. They're your friends, too. And you know how Lewis prides himself in keeping a place that's fit for ladies.
All right. The general store, then Longmont's it is.
15 minutes later, Smoke entered the saloon. Sally was still down at the general store. As was his custom, he entered the saloon and stepped immediately to the side, pressing his back up against the wall. He let his eyes adjust to the lower light inside while he looked for possible trouble among the patrons. He did this as a matter of habit in every saloon he entered. In truth, it wasn't necessary in Lewis Longmont's saloon. He was as safe there as he was in his own living room. But it was a habit he had cultivated, and all good habits, he believed, should be continued without an interruption in the routine. Longmont's was truly one of the nicest establishments of its kind that Smoke had ever seen. It would have been at home in San Francisco, St. Louis, or New York. It had a long, polished mahogany bar with a brass footrail that Lewis kept shining brightly. A cut-glass mirror was behind the bar, and the artwork was truly art, not the garish nudes that were so prominent in saloons throughout the West. His collection included originals by Winslow Homer, George Catlin, and Thomas Moran. Lewis was sitting at his usual table in a corner. He was a lean, hawk-faced man with strong, slender hands, long fingers, and carefully manicured nails. He had jet black hair and a black pencil-thin mustache. He always wore fine suits, white shirts, and the ubiquitous ascot. Today, it was a royal blue. He wore low-heeled boots and a pistol that hung low in a tied-down holster on his right side. The pistol was nickel-plated with ivory handles, but it was not just for show. Lewis was snake quick and a feared, deadly gun hand when pushed. He was engaged in a profession that didn't have a very good reputation, and there had been times when he was called upon to use that gun. Those times, he did so with deadly effectiveness. He was also a man with a very strong code of honor, as well as a belief in right and wrong. He had never hired, nor would he ever hire, his gun out for money. While he could make a deck of cards do almost anything, he had never cheated at poker. Hell, he didn't have to cheat. He was possessed of a phenomenal memory. He could tell you the odds of filling any type of poker hand, and he was an expert at the technique of card counting. Lewis was just past 30. When he was a small boy, he left Louisiana and came west with his parents. They had died in a shantytown fire, leaving the boy to cope as best he could. He had coped quite well, plying his innate intelligence, along with his willingness to take a chance, into a fortune. He owned a large ranch in Wyoming Territory, several businesses in San Francisco, and a hefty chunk of a railroad.
Smoke, mon ami. It's good to see you as always. What'll it be? Coffee, beer, wine, or whiskey?
It's before noon. I think a cup of coffee would be fine.
Make it two cups.
Sheriff Carson came in behind Smoke.
I just saw you drinking one cup. Now you're going to drink two more?
No, I meant... I think there's a bit of leg pulling going on here.
Andre, Lewis Longmont's French cook, brought two cups of steaming coffee and put them on the table in front of Smoke and Sheriff Carson. A few minutes later, Sally came in and joined them.
How's the roundup going?
We're just getting started. Cattle got scattered from here to hell and back during the winter. I've got all hands out finding them, rounding them up, as well as digging them out of sinkholes.
Pearlie's favorite task.
So, how's the law business going?
Got a new Dodger in yesterday for a man named Bill Dinkins.
Bill Dinkins. I don't think I've ever heard of him.
He got his name known somewhat back in Kansas. And when it got too hot for him there, he came here. Last month, he and three others tried to hold up the bank in Buffalo.
Tried to. He didn't succeed. What happened?
The whole town got down on him. That's what happened. When they come out of the bank, they ran into a hornet's nest. Half the town was armed and shooting at him, and they were shooting back. And here's the thing. Dinkins run out on his men. He could have gone back, helped them get remounted, then ridden on out. The shooting wasn't that accurate, for all that there was a lot of it. All three of his men were shot down the street, though they went down game. Dinkins ran, and now there's a nice reward out for him.
How much money did he get from the bank?
That's just it. He didn't get one red cent. Six men dead for nothing.
Six men?
According to the witnesses, customers in the bank, Dinkins got mad when the teller refused to turn the money bag over to him, so he shot him. There were two more of the townspeople killed outside the bank, plus all three of Dinkins' men. That made it a total of six.
How much is being offered for Dinkins?
Right now, just $500. Like I said, he didn't get one red cent.
But he did kill the teller.
Yeah, in cold blood.
Someone like that, the reward can only go up.
Yeah, I'm pretty much thinking that myself.
Smoke and Sally visited with their friends until noon. When Dr. Colton came in to have his lunch, Lewis insisted that they all have lunch on him.
Not me. The wife will be fixing a big lunch for me. She'd be some disappointed if I didn't come home for it.
Well, you could eat just a little here, then go home for lunch.
Yeah, I guess... No, I better not, but I thank you for the invite.
Tell us about New York, Sally. It's been so long since I was there.
Oh, New York is wonderful. So many huge buildings, 4, 5, and 6 stories high. Elevated trains whizzing all through the city, electric wires, telephone service. Oh, surely, there is no place in the world like New York.
You talk almost as if you'd rather you and Smoke live there.
Oh, no. I am living exactly where I want to live. Remember, I came west of my own accord, and I have never regretted it for one moment.
She met with the President of the United States.
The President? You met the President?
It isn't that big of a deal. He and my father were very good friends at one time.
What do you mean that isn't a very big deal? I think it is a huge deal.
Laramie, Wyoming. At the remark made by the young man, all the conversation in the Rocky Mountain Beer Hall ceased. Wesley Harley was an ugly man. He was bald, not because of his age, but because some anomaly in his genetic makeup left him completely devoid of body hair. None on his head, no eyebrows or eyelashes, no mustache, and no hair on his arms, chest, or anywhere else. His face was narrow, and his skin was drawn so tight across his high cheekbones he looked almost like a skeleton. He had been leaning against the bar with both his hands wrapped around the beer in front of him. He turned toward the young man who had spoken to him.
What did you say?
You heard what I said. I said you murdered my pa, and I intend to see you brought to justice for it.
Do you now? And just how do you plan to do that?
By telling the law. I'm going to tell him what you did, and I'm going to tell him where to find you.
You don't understand, do you, boy? The sheriff knows where I am. Hell, all the sheriffs in the West know where I am. They just don't want no part of me.
It ain't right. You murdered my pa, and I ain't going to let you get away with it.
Well, now, since I done told you that the sheriff don't want nothing to do with me, if you were looking for justice, seems to me the only way you're going to get that justice is if you do it yourself. But before we get on with that, who is it I'm supposed to have killed?
I don't believe this. You mean you can't even remember the name of someone you killed?
Sonny, I've killed so many of them, they all sort of blend in. What was your pa's name? And where is it I'm supposed to have killed him?
His name was Conyers. Enoch Conyers.
Oh, yeah. I remember him. He was cheating at cards.
My pa never cheated at anything.
Yeah, I recollect now. He wasn't cheating. He accused me of cheating. I called him out on it.
And you killed him.
You ought not to start something you can't finish. Sort of like what you're doing now, ain't it, boy? You started something you can't finish.
The expression on the boy's face changed from one of anger to fear when he realized what he had gotten himself into. Then, even the fear gave way to resignation.
Let's do it, boy.
The boy went for his gun. He had it but halfway out of the holster when Harley fired at him. The sheriff held an inquest that very afternoon, and because there were enough witnesses who saw what actually happened, no charges were filed. Elko, Colorado. Frank and Travis Slater had served 6 months in jail for burglary, and they would have gone to prison for a year if Chance Carter hadn't paid for a good lawyer to plead their case. Carter spoke to the judge when he was providing supporting testimony. The judge had taken Carter's testimony to heart, and he had given lenient sentences to both of them. Now that they were out of jail, they were working as hired hands for Carter. Carter's wife had died 10 years ago, and Chance had raised their daughter ever since. Carrie was 15 years old and just blossoming into womanhood. One morning, she came out to the barn carrying a milk pail. She smiled at Travis, who at 19 was the younger of the two brothers. Frank was 22.
Good morning, Travis.
Pretty soon you won't be needing to milk that cow.
What do you mean?
Why, the way you are tittying up, you'll be able to give milk yourself.
That's not a very nice thing to say.
Sure it is. You think Frank and me don't see how you come around us all the time, showing off them titties of yours?
I do no such thing, and I don't like the way you're talking to me.
Yeah, you do. You like it a lot. Otherwise, you wouldn't be showing off like you are.
I'm not showing off.
You ain't? Then what did you come out here for? Did you come out here just to put a burr under my saddle, or did you come out here so I could make you a woman?
Make me a woman? What does that mean? I'm already a woman.
Oh, no, you ain't. You ain't a woman until you've had a man like me.
He pulled her to him and forced a kiss on
Paul!
Oh, shut up! You want your paw to come running out here?
Travis, acting spontaneously, picked up the hammer he'd been using to adjust the iron wheel rim and hit her hard.
Get up! Get up and don't be screaming no more!
Well, she ain't going to be getting up.
Frank had been out in the corral, but he was drawn back to the barn by the young girl's scream.
Oh, yes, she is. Come on, get up!
Travis, take a look at her. Take a good, close look at her.
Travis looked down at the young girl and saw that her eyes and mouth were open, but she was totally still. There was a very dark bruise on the side of her head where he had hit her with the hammer.
Oh, damn, oh, damn, oh, damn. Frank, I've killed her. What am I gonna do? I didn't mean to kill her. I was just trying to get her to shut up.
Carrie, what is it? What are you calling me for?
Chance Carter, a man in his early 40s, stepped into the barn and saw the body of his daughter lying on the ground. He saw Travis and Frank looking down at her.
My God, what happened?
Oh, you see, I didn't think I hit her that hard.
You did this? You did this?
I was just funning with her. Then she started screaming, and I wanted her to stop.
You murderer!
Mr. Carter, listen to me. I didn't mean to kill her. I just wanted her to stop yelling is all. It was an accident.
Without any reply, Chance ran into the house.
What's he gonna do, Frank?
I figure he's going after a gun. And I figure he's going to come back out and commence shooting.
Frank took the hammer from Travis's hand, then hurried up to the big house. He stood alongside the door with his back up against the wall, and he waited until Chance Carter came back outside.
You son of a bitch! You killed my daughter!
Carter started toward the barn with a double-barrel shotgun in his hand. So intent was Carter on extracting retribution from Travis, he didn't see Frank step out behind him. Frank brought the hammer down hard, and Chance dropped to the ground. Frank got down on his knees beside the rancher and hit him again and again with the hammer. He didn't stop until blood, bone, and brain matter was pouring out of the wound.
I think you can quit now, Frank.
Yeah.
What do we do now?
We get our guns and we get out of here.
How are we gonna get out of here? The only horses Mr. Carter got is team horses. He ain't got no saddles.
Take the train.
Like as not, it's a freight train this time of day.
All the better.
Poncha Pass, Colorado. The freight cars bumped and rattled through the night, the thunder echoing back from Poncha Pass. On the 242 locomotive, the steam gushed from the drive cylinder like a cannon fire as it labored mightily to negotiate the grade. But five cars back, Frank and Travis Slater, who had hopped onto the freight when they had fled the Carter Ranch, could hear nothing of the engine. The car had been empty when the two brothers jumped onto the train, but just before nightfall, two other men climbed into the car.
You think the brake man saw us?
Nah. Anyway, I think it's Doodle. He's a good one. He don't ever throw you off.
In the dim light, the two new men saw Frank and Travis sitting in the forward part of the empty car, their backs braced against the front wall, so no matter how much the train lurched and jerked, they were able to keep from being tossed about.
Oh, hello, boys. Been on the train long, have you?
Not too long.
My name's Zeke. My partner here's Mickey. We know most of the riders, but I don't think we've ever run across you two before.
No, this is our first time.
Oh, don't want to tell me your name, huh? Well, no matter. Sometimes when folks is down on their luck, they don't like to give away their names. Oh, that's fine with Mickey and me.
Now, how many times have you hopped on a train on this line?
Oh, I'd say 20, maybe 30 times, wouldn't you, Mickey?
30 times for sure. You might recall one time we done it two times in the same week.
Yeah, I do recall. So this is your first time, is it?
Yeah.
Well, there's some things you need to know. If you listen to me, I'll be learning you some of them things.
We're listening.
The first thing is, you got to know what kind of car to hop. You got to know how far it's going. I mind the time Jimmy Peel. You remember him, don't you, Mickey?
I remember him well. He was a big man, maybe 6'4" tall or so.
Yes, that's the one I'm talking about. Well, sir, Jimmy Peel once hopped onto a car, and the door got shut on him so he couldn't get out. The car went all the way to New Orleans, it did, and when they opened up down there, well, they found Jimmy Peel dead. He'd done starved to death.
He died of thirst. As big a man as he was, would have took him a long time to starve to death. But it don't take hardly no time at all for a man to die if he don't got no water.
We sure going slow now. I could walk faster than this.
Well, that's because we're climbing up Ponca Pass. But we're near about the top now. You wait till we get over the top, then you'll see.
And I'll see what?
He'll see us speed up. The train will be going lickety-split, and I'll wager you'll be wanting to grab a hold of something so as you'll be able to hang on.
The train reached the top of the pass, then started down, gathering speed as the peaks lurched behind him in an increasingly faster rush.
Well, how fast do you think we're going, anyway?
Going downhill like this, I'd say 35, 40 miles an hour, maybe even faster.
Well, damn, I ain't never gone this fast before.
So this is the first time you boys ever jumped a freight, is it?
Yeah, that's what I said.
What'd you jump it for?
What?
I mean, you boys don't exactly have the looks of a rail bum.
Well, we jumped it for the same reason you did. We needed to get somewhere, and we didn't have no horses.
See, now that's the difference between you two and me and Mickey here. You said you need to get somewhere.
Yeah, so what's different? We're on this train just like you are.
No, you ain't. It ain't nothing like Mickey and me. That's the whole point. You said you're needing to get somewhere. Me and Mickey, we don't need to get nowhere on account of because we're already here.
What do you mean you already here? You're on a train going somewhere.
See, that's where you don't understand men like Mickey and me. We ain't going nowhere. We're already here.
And we'll ride this train for a while, then we'll ride another train. After that, while we'll hop on another train and ride it. We ain't going nowhere in particular, which means we're already here.
So how do you eat?
Just like anyone else, with our mouths.
No, I mean if you're on the train all the time, how do you get food? You don't have any money, but what do? Beg people for food?
Who says we don't have any money? We may be gentlemen of the rails, but we ain't beggars.
Yeah, we just got through working for a couple weeks making bricks. We got enough money to feed us for a month or so. Then when we run out of money, why, we'll find us some other place to work.
You don't hardly never see nobody riding the rails that ain't got some money. So don't you go getting on your high horse with us.
Well, just how much money do you have?
Seeing as how I'm just learning you boys about the life, what with you just starting out and all, well, I ain't gonna take offense to that question you just asked me. But the truth is, that ain't a question you ever want to ask anyone. How much money a man has is his own business.
Yeah, I see. So sorry I asked.
Well, that's all right. Like I told you, you two boys is new and you don't know no better, so I ain't taking no offense.
The train leveled out and slowed down. Zeke got up and walked over to stand in the open door of the freight for a moment. Then he came back.
Gilman's coming up.
What's in Gilman?
Oh, it's a new town. Has a store, a stamping mill, a cafe.
Does it have a saloon?
I expect it does. I ain't never been in it, though. Most of the time when we want something to drink, we just buy a bottle. Right, Mickey?
Yeah, we don't go into saloons because we ain't exactly what you call social.
Will you be getting off here?
No, we ain't got no reason to get off yet.
Frank got up and walked over to the open door to look outside.
You ever jumped off a train while it was moving?
Yeah, but you wouldn't want to do it if it was moving any faster than this.
Well, how do you do it?
Oh, it's easy. You just jump. Far enough out to make sure you don't fall back under the wheels.
And when you jump, you're gonna tumble some. So what you want to do is make sure you're facing toward the front. Otherwise, you could tumble backward and break your neck.
Well, come here, Travis. Have a look.
Travis got up from his place by the front wall and walked to the door.
How much money you think they got on them now?
Frank spoke just loudly enough for Travis to hear.
I don't know, $20-$30 maybe.
That's good enough.
Pulling his pistol, Frank held it down by his side and slightly behind him as he walked back to the front of the car.
So what'd you boys decide? You gonna jump out of the car?
After.
After what?
After this.
Why'd you do that? We could have just held them up.
They knew who we were. This way, they aren't likely to even be discovered for 2 or 3 days, hell if that. This car might wind up in San Francisco before anybody discovers them. By then, we'll be so far away, there won't be any way at all anybody can put together the fact that we're the ones who done it. Now, you search Mickey, I'll search Zeke.
Damn! I bet there's over $100 here!
Yeah, there's at least that much. Who would have thought that?
Come on, we better get off now.
Stepping into the open door of the freight car, the two men leaped clear of the roadbed. By the time they picked themselves up, the lighted caboose of the train was rocking past them. The two men watched the car grow smaller in the distance until all they could see was the glowing red lamp that was hanging from a hook on the end of the caboose.
What do we do now?
We follow the tracks to town.
It's the middle of the night. There ain't gonna be nothing open in the middle of the night.
We don't want anything to be open. When you're stealing horses, it's best that everyone be asleep.
Oh, yeah.
It was about 2 in the morning, so there was not one soul awake in the town. And the only sound that could be heard was the rustle of the wind through the limbs of the aspen trees. Frank and Travis stopped in their tracks.
I hope that dog is tied up.
I expect he is. Now look over there. Do you see what I see?
All I see is a lean-to.
With a couple of horses.
I don't see... Oh, wait, yeah, I see him.
Moving silently through the night, the two brothers reached the lean-to, where they found 2 horses tied to a rail and 2 saddles conveniently stored on a shelf to one side. They saddled the horses, then led them out into the open, keeping a close eye on the nearby house. Travis started to mount.
Not yet. Let's walk them all the way out of town first. It's quieter that way.
Yeah, good idea.